Hey guys, Will here. Just a quick note that this particular episode is going to be a little lighter on editing and feature some terminology that I normally try to cut, let's say. And as well, Aaron was having some headset trouble early on. It seems to have translated into the audio, so I do apologize for the quality of Aaron's track in particular this week. Still, I wanted to make sure that I got an episode of some kind out for you guys before we leave for Scotland, since that trip is going to make scheduling and editing kind of a bear for the next 2 weeks, since Nationals are the week after I'm back from Scotland. So hopefully we can have an episode out on the 31st. We will definitely be skipping the 24th, but hopefully the 31st. It may, however, be the 7th before the next episode. Thanks.
Ned and the girls were 8 days gone when Maester Lewin came to her one night in Bryn's sick room, carrying a reading lamp and the books of account. "It's past time that we reviewed the figures, my lord," he said. "You'll want to know how much this royal visit cost us."
Welcome to the White Book Podcast, the original A Game of Thrones LCG podcast. Founded in 2010 as Two Champs and a Chump, we decided to rebrand ourselves and relaunch at the same time the game did with a second edition. Each week we bring you a new dose of strategy insight and all-around geeky goodness. A huge thank you to Fantasy Flight Games, George R. Martin, and our patrons and fans. This wouldn't be possible without you. We have huge plans, and this year we get to enact those. We are going to be co-hosting Game of Thrones Nationals. Learn more at agotnationals.com. Also check out the community site at agot.cards, where you can find tons of community content and an event listing system. Would you believe that is the only time in five books that the word review is used? I'm actually amazed. It's a terrible quote, but I liked the novelty of the trivia.
Novelty is good when you've been doing these quotes for what? What episode number is this, Will?
This should be 347.
Across two different shows, 347 episodes. We're coming to 350 soon. It's kind of exciting.
How many full-time hosts have there been?
Full-time hosts? Depends on your definition of full-time host.
I mean, the original three, Daryl, Kyle, that's the first, like, five, right?
So, I think Glazer, it would be novel, Tommy. Except I'm fairly certain this quote has been used before.
Oh, yeah, we redo quotes. Me, then Tommy, then it's got to be like Roy, Luke, Patrick, Haynes.
Yeah.
Other Haynes. Jesse.
And then obviously. Scotty.
Scotty
before Jesse.
Yeah.
And then Jesse.
No, same time. I thought Scotty and
Jesse. The same. I thought Scotty came before Jesse.
And then. That's it, right?
Well, he was kind of a semi-regular guest host for a while before he officially joined. So,
because Kyle flaked a lot, so we needed someone to replace him.
Well, yeah, we've had a lot of episodes and a lot of hosts. Man, when you rattle them all off like that, it's more than I kind of realized over the years. Maybe we'll have to dream up some kind of super show sometime where we drag everyone kicking and screaming back on.
If Greg comes back, I think I have to quit. Sorry.
You just don't have them on the same segment.
Yeah, exactly.
That's simple.
I mean, I think the listeners would revolt.
We always thought the Aaron versus Greg episodes were always popular.
They were.
It was a good take.
Yeah, listeners liked that clash of viewpoints on stuff. It led to good discussion.
Hey, I forgot. It's 13. We had the summer of Bruno.
Oh.
Oh, man. But Bruno wasn't a regular host, though.
For one summer, he was on every episode. It was the
was
summer
he for
of Bruno.
Was it a whole summer?
Yeah, it was the summer of Bruno. He was like, I'm done teaching. I got nothing to do. I was like, want to host? He was like, yeah. And I was like, wait, what?
I did not remember he was ever on that consistently. I knew we had
yeah, him on. I don't remember that. Yeah.
Well, that was at the tail end of... It was still 2C1C then, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Or had it just relaunched?
I think it was 2C1C. It was just a...
Yeah, so... It was. I think it was that... Wasn't it that last summer before the last Gen Con Bruno went to?
Yeah.
Right?
I think so.
Yeah. I don't think it was the whole summer, though. I just
might have been
it,
up.
Just
it might
on,
have been up
like,
to Gen Con, too.
Yeah.
Will, do we always use the same quote for review episodes?
No.
No.
Will has an organization.
He usually picks one from
like that.
That fits the cards under discussion.
Yeah, that's usually what I go for.
Speaking of which, let's review some cards.
Wait, we can't jump that far ahead yet. We have to award a Patreon prize.
Only if you introduce yourself.
I have to introduce myself? Okay. If the listeners have been listening at this point and aren't aware that I'm Will, they might want to get that checked out.
I'll be Aaron.
I'm Roy.
Ooh, and who's our
last one? Kyle Vantle.
Ooh, I wondered who he'd be this week.
Well, we know that's why. Kyle Vantle's never on this podcast.
All right, everybody, Luke coming back for some more.
Luke has returned, and Kyle is now the ghost host.
Just can't get enough.
Okay.
He was supposed to be on last week, but he heard we weren't going to be on, and like, why go talk to the B team?
Oh! Ouch! Ouch!
Shade!
I thought you guys were the B team. You're the Hedge Knights.
We're the F team, if we're going to be completely honest.
Sorry, I
mean, you do
go.
Have,
was that
you do have me on
Frank?
Right now, so.
All right, let's do a Patreon reward. We got a
Patreon reward. I went ahead and hit the buttons, counted it up while we were fighting technical difficulties. We've got three more of the Midwest Circuit vowels on the line, and that goes to Mr. Matthew Slade. So, enjoy.
Oh, you didn't say Matthew S., so we didn't have to play guessing games. Good
no!
job.
No! I ruined it. I hope your identity is not a closely guarded secret, Matthew.
All right.
Oh, I doubt it.
I kind of hope it is.
Luke wants me to be sued by the government or something. Thanks.
Matthew Slater.
I don't think the government's going to be suing you, Will. I don't even think the NSA has time for us, and they have time for everyone.
Well, NSA, if you're listening, write us an email at contact@whitebookpodcast.com.
Or follow us on Google Plus, which is still a thing.
I hear it is.
Oh my god.
Okay, now that is
Listen to the last episode that I was on and hear all the disembodied laughs that I have that actually make no sense.
Well, that's par for the course, right?
No, at least like when I had technical difficulties with a jet engine taking off in the background, you could tell I was laughing at the joke at hand.
Well, you know.
You just couldn't hear what the joke was.
Things happen.
Right.
Yeah. Got a kitty coming to say hello.
Well, while Aaron says hello to the kitty, how about we say hello to a new pack of cards?
That's your transition.
I know, right?
Well,
I thought we had a really good one a minute ago, and then you guys kept talking, and so I just had to force it, okay?
All right.
Some things definitely have not changed.
No, not at all. Okay, so the pack is the Streets of King's Landing. So this is pack three in whatever this cycle is called. The Shadow Cycle is all I ever think of it as.
Isn't it called Shadows of Something?
Maybe.
Isn't it called the Streets? It's called the Streets of King's Landing.
Well, that's the chapter pack.
Cycle. Oh, the cycle is the King's Landing cycle, I believe.
Okay. Really?
There we go. Huh.
I believe it is.
In my head, it's just the Shadow
Cycle. Maybe the Shadow Cycle? I don't know.
They are getting really creative with these cycle title names.
We can just find out. Hold on. Well, it is.
It could be worse.
Almost as creative.
Shadow Cycle. Dance of Shadows.
Dance of Shadows. Okay.
I didn't know Shadows. I
don't, almost as creative as George's descriptions of food.
Oh, my God. Welcome back, Will.
Yeah. Welcome back, Will.
I don't.
Or not Will, excuse me, Luke.
I don't see a lot of
Luke,
shit.
Sorry. I'm tired.
Well, what? You're off. Roy's on vacation. He's whiny.
I'm always tired. That's
does that mean
secret.
We...
Like, the Hulk is always angry.
We go ahead and give him the honor of starting this chapter pack review off? I hear he likes Stark.
Oh, me?
Well, actually, I was saying Roy, but I'm not picky. I was just... trying to get him.
Oh,
ready.
I was going to say, I don't like Stark. I don't like Stark, but I like the
okay.
Stark card.
All right. So the first Stark card is a loyal 3-cost character with 2 icons, blue and red, 3 strength, non-unique, Umber Loyalist, House Umber traded. Reaction, after Umber Loyalist enters play, draw 2 cards. Force interrupt when Umber Loyalist leaves play. Choose and discard 2 cards from your hand. Then our second one, which is spoiled on the Second Sons, is White Harbor, a unique 3-cost loyal location. House Manderly, the North. Reaction, after you win a challenge, reveal the top 2 cards of your deck. Lose an opponent, adds 1 of those cards to your hand. Place the other at the bottom of your deck. So these are very ridiculous card advantage engines from Stark. I would give this faction an A to start off the pack, which I think is going to be a strong theme in this pack. It's important. A couple things to note, I think, about these cards is, first, Umber Loyalist, it's forced interrupt always triggers, but you don't have to discard cards if you have only 1 card in your hand, which is a pretty easy thing to arrange, I think, in the mid to late game. And so it's a good way to get around the supposed drawback of this card. And White Harbor, I think, is probably the more powerful of the two. I think the way Stark decks are, it will not be difficult for them to get at least 2 triggers. And of course, it works on offense and defense. So it makes doing challenges into Stark very scary, in the same way which Dorne does. And of course, it's a worse Dorne because you don't get to pick the card. But like, Stark decks are at the point where short of your limited cards, there are no bad cards in a Stark deck, and all of them are furthering your game plan. Like, some Stark decks aren't even running the 1 cost reducers. And so at that point, it really just becomes like, which medium to awesome card is your opponent going to give you, and you're going to be happy either way. And of course, even if they do just end up giving you limited locations, you're filtering your deck. To the point in which you will just, your draws will get better over time. And Umber Loyalist is just a really good, efficient chud. A 3-for-3 with 2 icons is very good. But the ability to draw 2 cards is extremely strong. And a faction that was previously sort of draw dead is now awash in a sea of cards. So Stark's in a great place. The cycle's been good to Stark.
So I think Umber Loyalist is fine. It's also worth noting that first reactions happen before a regular reaction, so if you have 1 or 0 cards and choose some wine in the Umber Loyalist, you don't have to discard, and you do still get Lyman's draw. The first reaction will have already passed. First interrupt, excuse me, will already have passed. I think there's 3 interesting and important things to note about White Harbor, beyond the fact that it's just really good and really powerful. The first thing it does is it reads that Stark is now one of the better economy houses in the game. You're basically always going to have all the economy you want in this house. People are going to give you locations. Stark's characters are extremely impactful. And even the ones that aren't are Wyman fuel, and they don't want to give you that either. So assume that you're going to be awash in gold early game. What that also means is the bottom of your deck is going to be character heavy. So anything that shuffles your deck, i.e. most notably Isle of Ravens, gains an extra bit of value. So you should be looking at something like Isle of Ravens, if not Time for Wolves and Building Orders in your start decks. And I lost my last point. Oh, lastly, Stark's main answer has always been attrition decks, and White Harbor is an excellent answer for attrition, because attrition basically runs you out of cards and answers, and White Harbor prevents that from happening. So this card sets up Stark's economy, solves its worst matchup, and if you can just remember to run some deck shuffle, it's an absolutely stellar card. This is definitely an A-plus pack for Stark.
Will, do you want to go or me?
I mean, I'll go ahead and throw mine out because it's going to be pretty short. I mean, I think this is an A pack for Stark as well. I don't have a ton of individual points to add on top of what Roy and Aaron already threw out there, because they were pretty detailed. I mean, this is a huge shot in the arm for Stark on the draw front in a very efficient way. In the case of Umber Loyalist, in a slightly less efficient way for White Harbor, but like you're still winning challenges, you're still getting what probably a reasonable minimum on this is 2 cards a turn out of it. Even the worst cards, like it's still a volume of draw that Stark didn't quite have before, and just having those cards in hand, whether it's more econ to just make sure you can play the stuff that you get through regular draw phase or whatever, like is still going to be impactful, I think. So, hey.
I think I'm with Aaron on this. I think I'm at the A-plus range, not just on the back of White Harbor, but also Umber Loyalist seems really, really good. I mean, I know that sometimes 3 cost is a little bit awkward, for like Claimstoke and that kind of thing, and his force interrupt can be a bit daunting at times, but I think that Stark with these 2 cards really gets a damned if you do, damned if you don't kind of thing, and I really love that aspect of it, that it's all on the board and it fits with the house theme, so it's a theme home run and a design home run, but like these benefit every single Stark deck that I've seen. Like the ones that want to go fast, you know, might need to dig early. And the ones that want to go fast want to win challenges. And even the ones that sort of hover around the, you know, mid-rangey kind of like 4 to 5 plot game and then kind of see what happens still want cards. So I don't see any downside for this. And because of that, I'm in the A-plus range. I don't need to harp on any of the other mechanics that everybody else has mentioned.
I want to build on one quick thing that Luke said there. Stark has always been card hungry, and in particular, with Wyman constantly chewing up your board, it's even more card hungry. So the fact that you now have just multiple sources of card advantage, basically, or if not card advantage, card quality or card parity, is just really pushes Stark into a really, it's up there now firmly with Tyrell and Martell. In its level of synergy and it's flooded in cards,
which is a huge jump over a relatively short time frame.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we'll have to rank the draw houses at some point, but Stark is right there. With the
top. Yeah.
Yep.
I guess Will should read Tyrell.
Sure. I can jump on it. First up, we have Lazy Leo. He's a unique Tyrell non-loyal character. He costs 2, has 2 strength and an intrigue icon. He's a maester. Oh, he has shadows, by the way. Should have said that. With a shadows 2 cost. And reaction after Lazy Leo comes out of shadows, choose a player. Shuffle any number of events from that player's discard pile into his or her deck. And then we've got Growing Ambition. This one is a Tyrell shadows event with a dash cost. It's loyal. It has shadows X. And then challenges action, search your deck for X different cards and place them in your discard pile. Shuffle your deck. Then choose an opponent. Return X cards of that opponent's choice from your discard pile to your hand. You know, is it cheating if I kind of just give this house the E rating for this pack? I mean, both of these cards are essentially kind of potential combo engines. Growing Ambition, I think the selection there is obviously going to be a lot stronger than Lazy Leo. Lazy Leo may actually wind up being more effective to cherry pick things out of your opponent's discard pile and shuffle them back into your deck, which, hey, there we go. There's another continuation of the great F of G tradition, shall we say, of putting both a particular type of effect and then kind of the counters to that in the same house. So that's always fun. You give them all the filtering and engines stuff for combo decks, combinations, if you will. And then you also put the answer to strip those out of the discard pile so they can't analyze it back in that same house. I don't know. Feels weird, maybe a little belated after FAQ updates to try and rein combo in, but Growing Ambition might be the tool we need to see something pop up. It's going to be a fine balancing act, though. It's pretty resource hungry in the early game, which is when you're going to get the best effect out of that, because hopefully there's just not other cards for your opponent to choose from. But I think it is going to be one that with some careful thought is going to surprise me. Someone's going to do something really cool with it that I haven't quite put together yet.
I think these are kind of boring. Like, I'm sure someone's going to do something stupid and janky with it, but, like, they're bad cards until they're broken cards, and those are never really, really interesting to me. Like, growing Ambition is ideally you're going to, like, pay one as the X, so that's three costs to go search your deck for a particular card on turn one, ideally. And that's probably really good. It's just also really boring. I'm just giving it a C and moving on, because I don't like these cards. I think this is probably the single worst chapter pack in the game for Tyrell cards ever.
Ooh, in the game?
Tyrell has never gotten that one card that I don't consider at least near auto, including some type of majorly good deck.
I'm too lazy to research all the packs right now.
I did that one day while we were doing something or other.
Was it?
I went through every single pack. Crap.
So,
like everything in the name of combo or something.
Aaron is wrong about this chapter pack because Growing Ambition is going to be we've already said going to be broken, but it's simply good right now, right? Because, so, spoiler alert, I played a lot of Tyrell over this year and played a lot of it at Gen Con, and where Tyrell sits right now is it doesn't have like a lot of specific draw or a lot of like burst draw that's particularly good if you don't have your like combo pieces. And when I mean combo pieces, I really just mean mace. And so the ability to, on the first turn, pay three gold and get a mace is busted. Like, that's just busted in the deck that Aaron and I and everyone built for Gen Con. It smooths it out and it's not a dead draw later. So say you still don't see mace, or you don't see this until the middle of the game. What you can do is that deck runs, except for its limited cards, runs zero bad cards. Zero. And so you can pull, though, Ambush Girls out of your deck. You can pull a variety of other cards that synergize with Flea Bottom out of your deck in the mid game and make it so more likely you are to draw mace with your regular non-burst one card at a time draw with Hightower. So early on in the game, it could just fetch you mace or fetch you Renly or whatever you need just on demand for a single, for three. Well, if you set it up for one gold, if you don't, for three. And then later in the game, it can just seed your discard pile with Flea Bottom targets and filter cards out of your deck so that your draws become better. So so even if your opponent ends up in the middle of the game giving you the dupe for your Gates of the Moon and the dupe for your what's the Red Wine Straits, you still have put two or three cards in your discard pile that are good for Flea Bottom and made your draws off the top of your deck better. So I think Growing Ambition immediately slots into good stuff at Tyrell and maybe at like a two of, and then it will just become broken once a combo like focused player really figures out how to abuse it. And then Lazy Leo is also a future combo card. It's definitely closer there. I'm closer to you, Will, and Aaron, that I think eventually Lazy Leo will be broken in a combo deck. But right now he's definitely like a D. So I would give this faction like a B minus simply because I am ambitious on growing ambition.
Ooh.
That was absolutely terrible.
Yeah, his ambition is that he gets a veggie burger. Such a great ambition. Let's move on.
Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah. I'll give this house a C because I think Lazy Leo is actually an actively bad card that doesn't actually make it into any decks until the scenario that you're coming up with happens. And I think growing ambition is a really good card just in general. So I'm just gonna average it out, give him a C.
So I'd also like to note one other thing that it just occurred to me. Every time like a broken thing comes out like combo, everyone goes, "Oh my god, why don't FFG just print cards to answer it?" And they do, but because that deck is so oppressive, we need tools like the restricted list to handle them. See when Lazy Leo is coming out? Well over a year after combo started, right? Like, that kind of the turnaround of creating these cards means that the answer card leaves us with an extremely unhealthy meta for an extremely long time. So that whole just print the answer, this is why that's not a good answer to that.
Agreed.
Kind of problem.
Though on the plus side, it means that the restricted list could theoretically be used in an even, shall we say, more living manner. With other stuff coming off as answer cards enter the pool, which is something I would theoretically like to see. I don't think Leo does it by himself, but in theory, I like
it. I agree. I don't want to read Night's Watch, so anyone?
That's going to fall to Luke then. I mean, I'll read, but if we want to have every host go.
All right, I'll do Night's Watch. As you all know, I love this faction. Okay, so we have Knives Scout as a 3-cost 4th strength military intrigue icon, non-unique character, also non-loyal ally ranger trait, no attachments except weapon. While there is a card in Shadows, Knives Scout cannot be declared as a defender. And then we have Miner's Pick, which is a 1-cost, non-unique, loyal attachment. Item, weapon, traits. Builder or steward character only. Attached character gets +1 strength, and then it has the +1 income icon. So the Naive Scout is an ultra-efficient card with good icons and a not insignificant trait in Ranger. The no cards in Shadows thing is a drawback, but he's super efficient. I just don't know what build this fits in at the moment because I haven't really kept up with Night's Watch decks other than what I saw at Gen Con, so I'm gonna kind of like refrain from making any like crazy blanket statements other than that he's efficient, and then as long as Shadows are in the game, we're gonna see effects like this. And then I think the Miner's Pick is really good. I don't know how many deck slots you're going to dedicate to it, but I think if there's a Night's Watch Cohort deck, then this card is definitely in there to be able to sack and go grab something else. So I guess if I have a grade to give Night's Watch, I'm just going to go with a... I think I'm going to go with a C+, because I think that there's a lot of upside, but I haven't really like given a lot of thought to how these things actually slot in the deck, so I'm going to hedge my bets on the lower end.
Okay, I think that this is a pretty underwhelming chapter pack for Night's Watch. I think Naive Scout slots into that Rangers deck that is always constantly almost there. But I still don't think it quite is the card that pushes it over. And I don't think it goes into defense builds because defense builds don't really need another target for first snow that sometimes can't defend. And then Miner's Pick is fine. And I think Luke hit it on the head where it might will go in a goat deck. It may also, once rotation hits, maybe slot into some kind of builder's build. And it definitely helps against Targaryen. But right now it's pretty bad.
Stupid gift is the first two cycles, isn't it?
Which gift? New gift is in the box.
No, Brandon's gift.
Brandon's gift is in the first cycle, yeah.
Oh, man. That cycle without builders is going to die.
I don't necessarily think that's the case, but because a lot of what makes builders work is evergreen, but you're definitely right. Well, it's something to revisit in a couple years. But anyway, if you wanted to keep going down the builder's route after rotation, Miner's Pick is a card to look at. But it's kind of underwhelming outside of a goat deck right now. So I think Luke's C plus is probably where I end up as well with Night's Watch here. But I would definitely keep an eye on Naive Scout.
Oh, I thought I was going to get ripped apart.
No. Like Naive Scout, now that's like, talk to me again about the Rangers deck when the new Jon Snow is released.
Sure.
And then Naive Scout goes up. But right now, I still think he's not the best. But that Rangers deck, as Sid showed at Thrones War, it's definitely almost there. And it'll get there eventually.
3-4 Bicons help. I think the Rangers deck is very close. I wouldn't be shocked if Knight Scout puts it over the edge. I think Miner's Pick is kind of bad. It's just Night's Watch has better attachments at the end of the day. It would certainly go in a goat deck. That's a good place for it. And I bet you that goat deck would look an awful lot like, not this past year, the year before, Roy's Night's Watch Reigns list. Mm-hmm. A list that looked like that would fit a Miner's Pick really well if that were switched to goat. What am I hearing in the background?
Oh, is that
I have no idea what that was.
Not on my end.
I don't know what it is, but it's still there.
It's probably on my end. Hold on.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, it was definitely on
my end. Yay, for once it wasn't me.
I was like, am I hearing like some kind of Asian music in the background?
Is that better?
Yes, it is. So I'm going to give this a nice C because Naive Scout is a bit above average and Miner's Pick is a bit below average. And I feel like averaging out to C is fair.
Yeah, Lentz. I think I'm probably on a C for this as well. I mean, if I were to break it up, I think the Scout's probably a C plus and the Pick maybe a minus. The Scout is, you know, efficient, but not particularly interesting. So I think it'll be a piece of that Rangers deck whenever it comes together, but I don't think this will be what puts it over the top. And the Pick is, I think, certainly at the moment, the worst of the non-limited income we've seen for any of the houses, and I think very likely to be the worst by the time we see the others as well. The most fragile, the most restrictive, and the least extra benefit from its kind of side perk. So, yeah, I don't really like it. That's me.
Okay. So, Barra?
Yeah. That's an exciting one.
Yeah. All right. Crazy how I got that in that Night's Watch. Valerian's Crew, House Baron, non-loyal. Cost 6, rank 5, military intrigue. Merc and smuggler, stealth. You may marshal or play face-down cards attached to Valerian's Crew as if they were in your hand. After you win a challenge in which Valerian's Crew is attacking, attach the top card of the losing opponent's deck to Valerian's Crew face-down under your control as an attachment with turbo. And then Blackwater Bay. House Barra loyal. Location cost 3. Westeros trade for reasons, I guess. Reaction. After the challenge phase begins, kneel Blackwater Bay to choose an opponent. Draw 1 card for each kneeling character that player controls. So before we go further, I have a question. What are the factions? Let's exclude Barra for now, because I'm going to talk about Barra. What are the factions with the least number of viable builds? Not the worst factions, but the least number of.
Lannister, yeah. And
Lannister.
Barra?
And one more.
Oh, wow.
Let's exclude Barra for now.
Greyjoy.
Greyjoy, yeah. It's Lanny and Greyjoy. Which are the two houses with the worst draw right now?
Lannister and Baratheon?
Not anymore. Lannister and Greyjoy.
Greyjoy, yeah.
Yeah. I don't think it's like every other house doesn't have a draw card. They have multiple draw cards. They have burst draw. They have one at a time draw. They have a consistency in draw with this pack. And for all we know, this could be coming later in the cycle for Lanny and Greyjoy, right? But like for the time being, like every house has like two or three at least. And Barra's on the low end, with Blackwater Bay, Red Keep, and then the Dom one being, I think, the only ones I could think of. But, like, with even with Barra on low end, every other house has this consistency of draw, which leads to, in my opinion, a much healthier, more fun game, so you're not just at the mercy of the Dom.
You know what's sad, Aaron? I think as you're talking right now, you're actually making me more bummed. Like, you're pulling me down about a different card later in the pack. I'll explain that when we get there, but...
I know which one we're talking about. We'll get there. But all that, like, and even, like, Targ, which seems like it doesn't have as much draw, has so many different weird card advantage things that aren't specific draw. Like, Marine and, like, their extra abuses of Flea Bottom and their play from discard stuff and their discard to put in, like, all that different extra stuff.
Action advantage.
Yeah, and Targ can just, like, explode on a board with nothing seemingly available. And so that's almost as good as draw in most situations.
Yeah, right. I think Barra and Lannister, and to a certain extent Greyjoy, they were the three best factions coming out of the core set. And Barra dominated the first, say, 6 months of the game. Lannister the first year and a half. And Greyjoy was close to one of the top factions, and the
Targ right there with him.
Yeah, but I feel like, particularly, I think Lannister is still have a hangover. Design still has a hangover from the big mistakes they made with particularly Lannister early on, where Lannister didn't need draw early on because its card quality was just so exponentially higher than almost every other faction's. But now that all the other factions have caught up or exceeded Lannister in their card quality, there's really no reason to play a Lannister faction card unless you want to go really, really, really fast. And that's sad, as much as I hate Lannister and all of its themes.
Yeah.
Let's come back to Lannister in a minute. Let's focus on Barra. So, just by the logic of how this game has worked, assuming Blackwater Bay does what I think it's going to do, what I think it's going to do is it's going to draw you at least two cards most turns, and then there's going to be a turn that draws you like five. But, like, most of the time it's going to draw you about two. Because we're going to say about one reducer and about one, because you're Barra, if you're running this card, you're clearly running Neil. Two extra cards a turn every turn. It's not like the Red Keep stops existing. That's going to draw you two cards fairly often. Like, now, suddenly, Barra has real draw. And if they have real draw, like, suddenly the redundancy they started getting in Neil matters. Suddenly, like, they still probably need a couple more really good characters. But a lot of the other things they do start to get significantly better. I think that's important. I think Blackwater Bay in and of itself puts Barra back on the map. Valerian's Crew, I don't know what to make of. It's going to be a super duper high variance. I don't think Barra has any way to make it more consistent. I mean, you could play, I guess, Barra, Kraken, or Greyjoy Stag to make it more consistent. There's a, what's it called? The one that, bounces a non-loyal card to the top of your opponent, your player's deck when you marshal it. Hagen's Daughter? Oh. No, I don't know.
Is it just Captain's Daughter, I think?
Yeah, it Captain's is Daughter. Captain's Daughter.
Yeah, something like Captain's Daughter would be pretty cool with this. You wait, and then you grab stuff. But like most of the time, you're just going to use it as a giant freaking 6-for-5 stealth body with military infantry that's pretty good. And anything you get that you can marshal is a bonus, especially if it stops your opponent from playing something important that way. It's still super expensive for Barra, which still has the, I think, the worst econ in the game. I don't think anyone's quite as bad off for economy as Barathean is, although a lot of the neutral economy has helped that. I think Valyrian's Crew is really interesting. I think it's going to win some games, but I think it's fairly often just going to be a body that's there. And I think Blackwater Bay is a super duper card, perhaps the best in the pack. Certainly, I don't think anything is especially better than it. If anything is else, that's great, and there's several other great things about as good. So I'm going to give this house an A, because I think Blackwater Bay is an S.
Okay. Who's up next in the chat, then? Sure.
I'll go. So I think Valyrian's Crew is trash. Like, I just have no desire to play this card. Like, 6 for 5 with stealth with good icons is cool and all. I think that reaction is super marginal at best. Like, maybe if all of a sudden Baratheon becomes, you know, like, 50% of the field, and then you get to, like, go nuts with being able to play cards that are attached to them, then sure. I guess that's a thing. But Blackwater Bay is just incredible. I want so badly to see this card in the wild, because I want to see what happens in a Barra Wars deck with 2 forced marches and see how quickly they can dig. The only thing that I'm wondering, just because I'm still kind of getting my feet wet back into Thrones here, is, like, you know, what is Barra digging for right now in terms of the way that they've been designed with this card? You know, like, what's their win condition that they're trying to find on round, like, 3, and they draw 4 cards with this thing? You know, what are they trying to see? And that could be a different discussion for another day. Yeah, and that's my first inclination. But then again, like, if you find it, right, like, if you find the dominant stuff, it's still going to take you, like, 6 more turns to win the game. So,
Robert still closes games. The problem with a lot of Barra cards is, like, they didn't have anything to support them. Right? Like, they didn't have the draw consistency, the econ consistency to support them, but, like, Robert, both Melisandre's, both Stannis's are still really good cards. Now they are increasingly getting tools that support them and facilitate them and give you plans to dig for them, or if something bad happens to your win condition, to find other interactions and other gas in your deck. So.
That's what I'm hoping for, and because I haven't played much Barra since pretty much the Corset day, so I'm really hoping for that. And the Valyrian's Crew really just highlights to me, like, a couple problems I have with Breaking Ties, which is that, like, it's going to be around, and, like, you're never going to play this if you know that somebody has the capability of playing it. And then number two, like, the fact that Barra basically can't play that card, because you're not, their only, like, real good eligible target is Moon Boy, and how much do you really want to sack him? And so I'm going to give Barra an A for the pack, because I think that Blackwater Bay is that good, but I think Valyrian's Crew is absolute garbage.
I'd like to see Barra get more stealth, because they have the thing that you pay a gold to kneel some stuff with it, and I think that's a
It's Maria. Yeah. It's the wife.
Maria.
I actually really hate that combo. That combo gets real obnoxious when it gets going. But I mean, everything that's said about Blackwater Bay doesn't need further articulation. But I'm going to defend Valyrian's Crew a little bit here, because I feel like a 6 for 5. Mill intrigue with stealth, it could be a 2 of in an aggressive Barra build, and, you know, like a Barra, particularly like a Barra dragon that can use Aegon to, like, cheat this out, and Barra dragon is already good. It's one of the better Barra builds out there, or if not good, was okay, because no Barra deck was, like, good, but was okay, and it definitely helps that, or some sort of, like,
It doesn't work. Like, it only works to get it. Like, it's still going to turn into hand, which, with the card that's under it, it's just going to discard
itself. Go to their discard pile, right? Like, they never get the cards back.
But that's the argument about the cards on the bottom of your deck. Like, don't matter.
Wait. But what I'm saying is, like, but hold on. It's pillage, but, like, I'm not talking, I'm just saying, my point is about this. The body itself is fine. Its traits are good. And then it has this marginal upside that, as long as you don't, like, that's what you only care about in this card, it's fine. Like, if it just never does it, if it just is a 6/5 stealth, that's fine in certain aggressive Bera smugglers decks.
Let me know when those turn up.
Like, that ability. And then maybe sometimes.
That's a thing.
It is a thing. Like Bera Dragon. I watched Dark Nash's games at Thrones War. It's a perfectly solid deck, and it's gotten more tools in the form of Blackwater Bay. There's, like, I would not sleep on Valerian's Crew as, like, a 2-of card that sometimes lets you steal someone's mace.
I mean,
or things like that. That, like,
that's locking out uniques is big. You're right. Yeah,
it's like pure. It's just like pure upside. That, like, if the worst thing that happens, you pillage 3 cards off their deck. Right, like, okay, you pillage. It's, I mean, like a head pillage.
So
you need 1/3 challenges.
Excited
you pillage
to play
it.
A
okay.
6-cost like Vicon with stealth and pillage. Like, I'm not finding room for that as a non-unique.
So,
I can't great haul it. I can't dupe it.
But if you keep it with, but if you keep it in play, it doesn't read pillage, right? If you keep it in play for even one march to the next marshalling phase. What it reads
well,
is essentially
but it depends
a card
on
off
what
their deck.
I mean, to just grab, say, a couple locations from a popular deck, let's say, right? Like, what are the odds you pull a Redwyn Straits, which is great, or you pull a Hightower, which is going to cost you 4 gold and do nothing in your deck?
Oh, man. You know what? I would pay that four gold.
If they don't have it in play,
okay,
you get a, you, they can't play Hightower. like I think Luke thinks that the ability to nuke uniques is the most powerful upside of it. But, like, I'm not saying this is the greatest card. I think it's a C card. And I think the faction is an A because Blackwater Bay is S tier. But, like, I feel like people are underselling that there is a aggressive Bera deck that Valerian's Crew ends up being pure upside. Like, you just ignore the reaction until it matters, until you can marshal someone's Victarion off it or marshal someone's Eddard off it. Which will happen sometimes. And the times it happens is awesome. But if it doesn't, in an aggressive deck, stealth on a 5-strength military intrigue icon is powerful, particularly when Bera doesn't have access to good options on those icons if they want to push through, particularly an intrigue challenge. Short of Neil.
I'd also like to note that, I think that it's hard to judge this deck in and of itself. Not because of anything it's doing or not doing, but because what it helps Bera do is win challenges, and that's not what's stopping them in the meta right now. What's stopping them in the meta is that they have no answer to mace, and it's extremely hard to play any deck that can't handle mace.
Correct. That is true.
So, like, all of our judgments of it are in the current time frame, the current meta. If something else, like, I don't know, a dragon that burned down 4 by winning a challenge or something, or printing came out, if something like that happened to happen and that, like, knocked down Mesa Peg, then I think we're looking at a different Bera. We have a different conversation about cards. Alright, Will Reed Lannister.
Woo, Lannister. Okay. First up, we've got Cat's Paw. This is a non-loyal, non-unique Shadows character. Cost 2, strength 1, intrigue icon, ally. It has Shadows 2, and reaction after Catspaw comes out of Shadows. Pay X gold to choose another character with printed cost X or lower and return it to its owner's hand. And then we've got Goldmine. This one is a 2-cost loyal Lannister location. At the Westerlands trait. Action, kneel Goldmine and discard 1 card from your hand to draw 1 card, and plus 1 income. I think, overall, I probably still give Lannister an A out of this pack. I'm super excited about Catspaw when I first saw it. It feels like a solid addition to Lannister on a control front, which I miss being able to try to tackle out of Lannister. They've long abandoned that in second edition. I've definitely seen some folks lately kind of comparing this to something like The Things I Do for Love, and pointing out that that doesn't see play. And I think a good portion of that is, you know, despite the fact that Catspaw could be very expensive to bounce something large, it can't just be canceled for free by the Hand's Judgment like The Things I Do for Love can. So I think that's a boon. It can also bounce some of your own stuff. So maybe there's something here that wants to take out opponent's stuff if they've got the option, or send their own Queen's Assassins back to hand or something like that for some extra triggers. Heck, even a Gregor if something crazy is going on. I don't know. But I like that it's versatile and actually triggers off of Coming Out of Shadows. I'm glad to see cards that actually need shadows to do their thing in this pack. On the other hand, Goldmine is the card that I was super crazy excited about, but actually Aaron made me more depressed about while he was talking about Bera a minute ago. Because I was really excited to see, like, this is some fantastic filtering for Lannister. Like, it's reasonable income. Granted, they long ago lost their income superiority as a theme to half the other houses, but mainly Tyrell. But Goldmine is going to hopefully really filter you into some cool stuff. Unfortunately, it's still, like, card neutral at that point. It's not an actual advantage. It's just filter. And as Aaron got to talking about these things earlier, I realized, oh, shoot. Yeah, like that still leaves Lannister in the lurch in the end. You know, it's going to be a help, a boon, but without, a bulk of cards in hand, I'm a little worried that this does the work I want it to right now. So, I'm not sure I actually gave them a rating out of this, did I? I think I still gave them an A.
So the most important thing,
Roy, do you want to go?
Yeah, the most important thing about Goldmine is it's non-unique. That's kind of busted. I think that it's actually, I don't think it's it's not really the lack of draw, I think, that's making Goldmine a little less ideal in Lannister right now. I think it's that fact that Lannister doesn't have any super great discard synergies for Fleabottom outside of the Hound. Although, like, the ability to, like, particularly since it's non-unique, discard the Hound, bring it in with Fleabottom, win a challenge with the Hound, bring it back, and then if you have a second one, discard the Hound again and, like, just, like, start chaining things. I mean, that's, like, a cool interaction that Lannister can do. And there's some cool things that Lannister can do with it and really abuse the card. But I do think that, like, all mid-range Lannister decks, particularly, like, the Lanny Wars, like, kill 'em all decks, really will benefit from Goldmine, because they run a little bit higher curve, so additional good economy is useful, particularly to help up on setup. The ability to, like, you know, the thing about the Lanny Wars deck is, for the Lanny Wars deck to be successful, it runs a lot of, like, marginal cards that are good in some matchups and terrible in the other. So the ability to, like, chuck an Ill in Pain against, like, a Bera deck or something like that, or another Lannister deck, like a Lanny Rush deck or something, where you don't really need Ill in Pain to draw a card, but it would be great, and things like that. Or to chuck dupes for dead characters, because Lannister runs so many uniques at least 2x. Like, there's just, like, a lot of useful interactions with Goldmine to create just card quality. And Catspaw is, I think, pretty strong. People are down on it. I know the initial set of reviews have been pretty, pretty bad. And I think that with Targaryen likely becoming even stronger and stronger, particularly Targaryen Burn with the incoming dragon, the one strength is going to hurt a lot. But at the same time, like, an aggressive Lannister strategy that really wants to, like, kill them all out of like wars. Like, we'll like Catspaw as another way to sort of get characters out of the board, to open up marches, to open up Illyn Payne's, to open up King Joffrey's. So I think that's like, it's like a C card, and Goldmine is definitely an A, so probably a B plus pack for Lannister.
So Catspaw being Shadow 2 makes me actively angry. Like, you have to pay 4 gold for this shit before you get any part of its effect. Like, that's terrible. Like, if this was Shadow X, it would be really good. It'd be a great Martell card, not a great Lannister card, but it'd still be a great card. That you have to pay 4.
Oh, Aaron, you took my thunder.
Oh, no!
Really? Think as Martell cards first? Come on.
Well, nobody else is talking about it. So I was like, no, yes, this is a great attrition card.
Martell is not paying 4 to be like, aha, I got your... Like, Martell has a card that's basically 2 cost that does this, right?
Exactly.
Like, it's just... it's miserable that you have to pay 4 for it. I think this card is... Look, it's probably fine because its effect is so strong, but, like, in almost any other house, I look at this and I'm just disgusted. It's kind of trash, so I don't like it. And I'm not going to rate it highly, even though it's got an awesome name, because I love cats. But the gold mine is truly excellent. It's super repeatable. The fact that, like, you're constantly filtering 2 to 3 cards a turn with this, if you can see multiples, is really, really, truly great. Like, ask Targ with Marine how great it is to do this even temporarily. Because if you see 3, that's functionally what you got, right? Like, I would be digging for 2 of these as soon as possible in every Lannister deck. I think it totally changes the house in nothing but positive ways. I don't think only Midrange. I think Rush decks that want to, like, oh man, I dead drew that, and I need to get rid of it quickly. Like, the fact that this is an action instead of a phase, this is so good. It might even make me want to run the other bad land draw card, Lannisport, because, like, every card I get now, I can, like, try and make it something better every single time. And I think that this is an amplifier. I think Lannisters still need a lot of help, but this is the biggest step in the right direction they've got. So, an A plus and a D, so we're going to say a B minus. This is the best. Wait, one more thing. This is the best card Lannisters got since at least Cycle 2.
I think that's probably true.
That's fair, yeah. Yeah, I think, I was super pumped about that reaction ability on Catspaw, too. I love bouncing to hand. I think that's, like, a really fun way to play the game out of a house that, that likes to spend its money, like, in the challenges phase. But having to pay $4 just to get it down to do anything, even to bounce a Chud, you're still paying $5, and that's tough. So I'm not as high on Catspaw as I was when I initially, like, saw it and was like, oh yes, more bounce tech. I want to play that deck now. Goldmine's super dope. Like, being able to set that thing up is just incredible. But I think, like, Will kind of clued me into something that, like, from a design philosophy perspective, I kind of hate that there's such a preponderance of draw and card advantage effects that are, like, so heavily concentrated in a few houses factions, that cards like this just kind of piss me off now, because I'm just like, you printed so many above the curve cards, like, throughout the course of the game that benefit these other factions, like, what? Why not give Lannister something to, like, broaden its range that's not just the hyper-aggressive crossing build, or the hyper, not really aggressive, but the, like, maximum mid-range build that kills everything, right?
So I'm going to step in.
I'm still in the...
For a second.
Yeah, go ahead.
Like, let's just not pretend, though, that Lannister never got good cards in this game. Right, like, they made a
I'm not pretending that at all.
It's just been a very like, long time. Okay.
So I just went through. I just went through every chapter path. Down back to Lines of Casterly Rock, which is at the end of the second cycle, right? Yeah. There is no card as good as this from then to now. So from the end of the first cycle to now, this easily, like, far and away the best Lines of Casterly
Rock. Well, I'm just talking about the fact that, like, there are so many above-the-curve card advantage cards, and I'm not talking about character quality, because Lannister still is totally in contention for the best character quality in the game. I just, like a card like Goldmine, I'm super stoked to play with because I still like to play Lannister, even though I haven't played it in a while. Targ has really been my house of choice for about a year and a half now. But yeah, I'm still going to give this pack a B+ for Lannister because I think that Cat's Paw could have been something really cool, even as a banner card. In a very aggressive, like Tyrell Lion or a very aggressive Martell Lion, but just the fact that it's so expensive, I just don't see many folks running the card, so I'm at B+.
Who wants to read Greyjoy?
I'll do Greyjoy if I also get Martell.
Sure.
I'll just read the damn Greyjoy cards. Jesus. So you can read you can read your beloved Martell card. At least I get.
Yeah, sorry, go ahead, Luke.
Oh, Canadian standoff. Nice offer. Okay. at least I get a good card. Drowned God Fanatic is a free cost. 2-strength non-unique character, loyal with a military and intrigue icon with the Drowned God trait. Action. Kill a character to put Drowned God Fanatic into play from your dead pile, max once per round. Interrupt. When the effect of an opponent's triggered character ability would initiate, place Drowned God Fanatic into your dead pile from your hand to cancel those effects.
Come on, you gotta read the bottom
and
thing
then,
too. Card designed by?
Yeah, sorry. Oh, sorry, I forgot. Yeah. Card designed by 2013 European Melee champion Vincent Toulet. Dragonbinder is an attachment, a unique attachment that is non-loyal. It is an item, character you control only. Attached character gains Intimidate. Reaction, after you win Dominance, kill attached character to either choose and take control of a dragon character, or search the top 10 cards of your deck for a Greyjoy character, put it into play, and shuffle your deck. I don't even know how to give a grade to these two cards, because I think Dragonbinder is, like, super whatever flavor home run, but yeah. Drowned God Fanatic is dope, though. Like, at the very least, he's giving you Drowned God triggers and an available cancel that Greyjoy doesn't generally have. Good icons. He just does everything that Drowned God deck wants to do and even normal Greyjoy decks want to do. So I think he's really, really good. The Dragonbinder is a funny card. I don't even know what to think about it. I guess in a cohort deck, it could be really interesting if there's other three cost or lower attachments that you really want to see. And just getting the extra Intimidate is cool. Plus the upside on the reaction ability can come into play in very like certain scenarios. I don't know how to rate this. I guess I'm going to give Greyjoy like a B because I think that Drowned God Fanatic is really good. I just don't know that Dragonbinder makes it its way into a lot of decks. I'm interested to see how y'all feel about it just because, like I said over and over again, I haven't really played with the full card pool for more than a few months. And so I'm hedging my bets and saying that Drowned God Fanatic's really, really good, but I don't want to like push them way up into the stratosphere, so I'm going to go B.
I mean, I'll jump out here. I think I mostly agree with you here, Luke. I think Dragonbinder looks
kind of interesting. I can't believe I can still rate cards. This is nuts.
I mean, it looks kind of interesting and impressive, but it's one of those cards that when you kind of like sit down to stop and look at it, like you're putting a lot more work into it than what you possibly get back out of it. I mean, sure, there's going to be the times when you drop that on, you know, a fishmonger and then win dominance and then turn them into seven cost Asha, but at a, only searching the top 10 and then having to line everything up. Have the character you don't care about, and you know, spend three on this, and dominance, and everything. Like, I just don't think it's going to line up to be efficient enough to actually really see play. Drowned God Fanatic, though, on the other hand, I see very little downside to whether you're playing a Drowned God deck or not. Just a free pseudo treachery, I think, is going to be very strong. Like, there's only so many houses that can surprise cancel a character ability when someone's counting on that to go off. And I think that's going to be a huge boon to Greyjoy to have that
person. It is too, right? Like, it's them and Lannister and anyone else.
Yeah, it's just them. I mean, anybody else could have a Septon on.
Yeah, but surprise, you said.
Or a, right.
Yeah, I mean, Vince printed probably in the most busted champ card in a while, like, which they saying a lot.
Wasn't Wars to Come like
Wars to Come is not busted.
How long ago was Flea Bottom printed? Flea
Bottom's printed like a year ago, right? It was at Gen Con last year, right?
It's been a while.
Yeah, this is definitely more.
It was a year ago. Holy cow, I've been away from busted.
Wars to Come is not, I mean, that's actually a whole episode that I actually think we should do. About Wars to Come. I don't think Wars to Come is busted. It's above curve. But anyway, this card is like Flea Bottom level busted, though. Like, because it is really good in just good stuff, Greyjoy, as like a 2-of, 3-of treachery substitute that really helps things like bad matchups for mid-range Greyjoy, like Varus decks. It helps answer Mace. It helps answer just a bunch of bullshit that Greyjoy hates. So it helps Greyjoy mid-range. Okay, that's awesome. In Drowned God decks, it's a super busted card that just does literally everything they want that you could possibly do. It has funny interactions with funny interactions with Breaking Ties, where you can, it's just a really just super powerful card. And I think it's actually an S-tier card. And I expect people to start seeing Drowned God again, and it's going to be much more consistent because it provides just another outlet and an even more like busted outlet than the cudgel was before it got its errata. And then Dragonbinder is the most pushed attachment in the history of second edition. Like, Danny is just literally screaming in your face right now, play this card, right? So it gives the attached character intimidate. It can steal a dragon, which is going to become much more of a real thing when like 50% of the meta is Targaryen, thanks to the upcoming Targaryen cards. And it also lets you search the top 10 cards of your deck for a Greyjoy character. And the way Greyjoy decks are built right now, particularly mid-range ones, like the top 10 cards is going to contain one of a million good seven costers you have. I would not be surprised if Dragonbinder slots in as a cheeky one of in mid-range decks, simply because that Intimidate is super sweet, and the ability to later trade a character out for a better character is pretty good, actually. In a cohort deck, it will definitely see play. So I would not sleep on either of these, and I would give Dragonbinder on a loan is like a C-plus card, and so I would give the overall faction like B+.
I think you guys are really underestimating Dragonbinder. So Doharis is a lot of what keeps Greyjoy in check, or at least bothers it. Like, I could stick this on a mid-cost guy, my 3-4-cost guy, keep that in Euron, then just next turn be like, boom. And now I have two giant guys again. It cost me nothing extra. I didn't have to pay anything extra. And until then, all I did was have a really good intimidate body. Like, that's real strong in and of itself. Like, and you're going to see something. You need Triss, you're going to search for Triss. Like, if summons had higher initiative, I'd be running summons in all my Greyjoy decks. And this is basically summons, but I get intimidate in the meantime. Like, I don't really have trouble winning dominance in Greyjoy when I want. I think that you're severely underrating Dragon Fighter. I think I'd run a two of us when they could figure out how to afford it, which is the question, absolutely. But if I can figure out how to afford it, and, like, do we know what the Greyjoy non-limited does?
I don't think we do yet.
I don't think we do yet, yeah.
Okay, well, assuming that that's anywhere near as good as all the other ones we're seeing, like, Greyjoy should start to have a lot better economy, right? Like, and if that happens, then suddenly Dragonbinder is awesome. I don't really have much sad about drawing out Fnatic. I wish it wasn't printed. I think it's probably just too good. That said, it is really goddamn good. It's definitely an S-tier card for all the reasons already enumerated. It's a 3-of, I think, in every Greyjoy deck forever. I can't imagine why you wouldn't run this. Like, it's just so cheap. Like, even if you just had to marshal it, like, a 3-for-2 with the icons Greyjoy wants is still really good. I mean, 80% of the time, though, you're just not marshaling it, right? Like, this card is stellar, and I'm giving this faction an A. Is that everyone?
I think it might be.
Okay, it's 2-1 start. I guess that should
no,
be.
No, I think that makes it Roy. Or, no, sorry. Who? Wait, yeah, they argued. Who did wind up reading Greyjoy? That was Luke. That was
Luke. I'll read Targaryen. So
yeah,
I fell on.
So we have Hired Assassin, which is a non-unique, non-loyal, 2-cost character with red and green icons, 1 strength mercenary, Shadow 2. Reaction: after Hired Assassin comes out of Shadows, look at a card in Shadows. If it is a character, you may place it in its owner's dead pile. And then we have Queen's Guard, which is a 3-cost non-loyal attachment, non-lady character only, Shadow 2. Action: discard 1 card from your hand to stand attached character, limit 3 times per round. So I think, let me talk a little bit about Hired Assassin, which I think is a niche card right now, but still pretty strong. I think it'll be much easier to assess once the cycle is over. I think the problem with Shadows as it exists right now, and probably as it will exist for the life of second edition, is the Shadows pool is really narrow. So if we end up in a situation where Shadows characters are the predominant Shadows cards, which is where they are right now, Hired Assassin is pretty good. It's pay 4, kill their Shadows card, and the Shadows cards that exist, particularly like ones like Aegon or Sir Garrus or just most of them that see play, you build a whole turn around them, and the ability to go first or just bring it out in the marshaling phase to kill their Aegon is a huge thing when their challenges phase was built around it. But if for some reason it like Shadow's locations at the end of the cycle become semi-predominant, then Hired Assassin becomes a little worse because you can whiff. But right now it's pretty strong. I could definitely see it in some Targ decks that are worried about some of the Shadows cards. If the Rookery format takes off, Hired Assassin goes in the Rookery of most Targ decks, but it's like a C+ card. And then Queen's Guard. So there's actually been a lot of debate in my build group about whether this is good. I'm on the side of it is good. It goes on any non-lady character, which is ridiculous. And I think the discard 1 card from your hand to stand attached character, it's non-loyal. Sure, it has a limit, but that limit is 3. And it's just a ridiculous card. I think this card will see play, and it will be really frustrating and really annoying on things like Khal Drogo. And it can just go on your banner characters as well, or your main house if it's brought in with banner Targ. So it's a combo card as well. So definitely expect to see banner dragon combo decks that use Queen's Guard. So this is like an A minus. Queen's Guard is like an A- card. And so I would put this faction at a B.
Can I pop in real quick just to ask a question to kind of pick your brain, Roy? Because I'm racking my mind here about Queensguard. And I'm trying to think, is there any flavor or interesting mechanical reason for this to be Shadows other than the like slight corner case of playing this on setup when you don't have a character to put it on and you want to wait a couple turns? Like this, yes. This one seems to be one of the more head scratching.
Why doesn't it give the Queensguard trait?
Well, that's the ultimate like WTF moment that Luke said. It's like, why doesn't it give the Queensguard trait? Not that the Queensguard trait means shit. And is there any characters with Queensguard?
I agree. Did that one Barristan have it?
No, I don't think so.
The 5-for-4 guy who stands.
No, I think it's just knight,
right?
So
I'm checking
thematically. I think that this card represents Barristan coming out of the shadows as from being what's his name? He was tied in. When he comes out of whatever he was hiding as the squire. And then comes and is the leader for Danny and Danny's. Yeah, there we go. I can't remember.
Yeah, good disguise. Good disguise.
Well, I mean, he only needs to trick Danny, and Danny's never met him. So, it's not a great disguise, but it's not like the stupidest thing in Martin's books. But,
no. We read all the
But anyway, before. That's if we're looking for where this comes from. That's where it would be. It would be that, like, and also, like, thematically trying to match the idea of, like, the Kingsguard or the Queensguard jumping out of shadows to protect their monarch, which I think is also some of the theme that Nate was going for with the shadow cycle of Kingsguard in first edition. So that, I think, is the space that Danny's playing with here, but it's not super well articulated. Like, a lot of these, like, pay one more gold for cards that aren't really Shadows cards.
I mean,
cards.
Do you ever bother to play this in Shadows?
We're about to talk about one in Martell.
I mean, do you ever bother with Shadows on this? Then this feels like one
on setup.
On setup, and if targets a Shadows location, right?
Yeah, like maybe
Martell and Lannister do.
Yeah.
I think that this is a Lannister. Like, okay, this is a Targ card in that Marine makes its discard cost free, right?
Yes.
Like Marine basically reads in challenge phase, stand at character 3 times. Yeah. Which
Yay.
Which is a little nutty. But otherwise, I think I just want it in Lannister. Like I feel like a big Tywin is good stand. Yeah. Maybe start.
What's his face?
So much stand that they don't want this, I don't think.
Sir Ilyn Payne with this on it.
Sir Ilyn Payne, machine gun out your boot.
Oh yeah.
You can get some icons on Gregor, be like, yeah, I like my builder Gregor bullshit. You know that.
You can make Miri.
Lion, you get the dragon and Gregor. So every military challenge, you get the Gregor roulette and the burn 4.
Oh God.
You could use it to stand Valyrian's crew.
It's true. That can take attachments for some reason.
Like, really? The whole crew.
There you go, Roy.
That's dumb. Scott's going to be really annoyed.
There you go, Roy.
Yeah.
Whatever. I think Hired Assassin's a fun card. It'll be good eventually, but we're not quite there yet. I assume by that middle of next cycle. Like, everyone's going to be running 5 or 6 Shadows cards in their deck, at which point Hired Assassin is a really good card. For now, it's bad, but soon it's really good. So I'm going to give this a B-.
B- for me. I think Queensguard is dope, and I think that Hired Assassin is good, even if you don't hit a character, because you get that information when there are more Shadows cards. Neither of these things really do much for me in the way I like to play Targaryen, though I'm probably just kind of on this, but like, they could, like, once I play around with them, they could be a little bit higher for me. I'm just, I'm saying B minus as a plus because Queensguard seems pretty silly if you can get it going.
Martell?
I think you going to read Martell?
I'm going to read some Martell cards. I mean, I'm also going to read one of the neutral cards, and it's definitely going to be like a card away. So, whatever. Sir Archibald Ironwood is a Martell non-loyal card. It's a character. It's 5/5. House Ironwood and Knight. Military icon. Shadow 4, no attachment except weapon, which is real sweet because you want to build this guy real bad. Reaction. After you lose dominance, the winning opponent must choose and kill a character he or she controls. I just want to stop and like have a moment of silence for all my opponent's boards. And then there's Summer Seaport, which is a loyal 2-cost location. It's Dorne. It is not limited. +1 income, +1 reserve. So I'm going to talk about the Summer Seaport first, very quickly. What is that sound?
Yep.
Hello?
The only sound What's I've been up? Hearing is sound. The kind of
robot-y
crackliness on yours that we're...
It sounded like someone speaking in tongues in the background. I was very confused. All right. Summer Seaport first. Summer Seaport is not great. It's good, but it's not great. Martell likes to play the long game. Like, even in their stupid, boring Doran's game decks, they like to play the long game. And having reserve and not having to chuck a bunch of cards, especially because Blee Bottom is more vulnerable than ever, seems really helpful. I'm not sure how often I run this, but like very often I'll just need that one extra economy card in Martell. And I prefer attrition to Doran's game, boring bullshit. So I think Summer Seaport is probably a better call for attrition than something like what's the 1/2? Gold card? +1, gives you +2 gold.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, Gates of the Moon.
I think for attrition, Summer Seaport is almost certainly a better call in Gates of the Moon, despite the extra cost, because you can afford to wait. And I think that this ends up being really good. Sir Archibald is goddamn near broken. He's freaking phenomenal. Martell does a real good job of keeping your board small when they want to, and Sir Archibald makes that just ridiculously better. That he's 5 costs, so you can already on him in without any trouble is amazing. That you can't milk him is amazing. That you can't ward him is amazing. Once he's on the board, you're basically just stuck with going like, oh man, I really don't want to win dominance. And he's a 5/5 mil, so even defending that military is really obnoxious. So like, you're very often going to be stuck with the choice of like losing mil to him and then losing dom also, which is just all sorts of rough. He basically makes Martell have 2 claim pretty goddamn regularly. He's amazing. He's an S card. Some Seaport's probably like a C plus, but I'm giving House an A minus.
Yeah. Archie should not have been printed, probably. He's a gross card. Particularly, like, he's non-loyal, too, so there could definitely be some Banner Sun shenanigans that you could do with him. But, yeah, he just really pushes a Martell attrition strategy. I don't think he's, like, a 3x card. But as a one of, until he gets Valored away or put under a deck because of a Valored O'Harris, he's going to cause nightmares for you. I don't necessarily think he's ever really going to come out of shadows all that often, but... 5/5 mil icon is really good. I think it helps the Martell attrition strategy against Tyrell a lot, because Tyrell, the way it's moving these days to like smaller boards that can defend challenges really well, but like doesn't have a lot of room for margin of error. And all Archie does is like squeeze that even tighter, because like you're going to start taking dupes off your lefts, stop taking dupes off your rights. And then you set yourself up for the Martell player's Valor and to lose the game. So he's just a really, really, really strong card. Summer Seaport, is one of the best of the non-limited ones, except that Martell already has above the curve economy. So it's sort of the rich get richer card. You'll see it in some Martell decks, as Aaron said, probably maybe attrition decks or some kind of like Martell stag. Like a real degenerate kind of stall you out, Stag. Kind of just hold all the cards.
Stag, if you can potentially get a 5 reserve, you end your die turn.
Yeah, like there's just like a lot of dumb stuff you can do with that card like that. But like, I don't think you'll see a huge amount of play simply because Martell just has busted economy, and you know when and this is. So maybe when the fiefdoms rotate, this will become the go-to Martell economy card. But, you know, until then, maybe you'll see one or two ofs to round out econ packages from Martell. But fiefdom is just such above curve that I can't imagine not wanting to play it. And spots are tight in Martell decks because Martell is the rich get richer house up there with Tyrell. And so, yeah, this is, I think, a... I'm going to go real aggressive and say this is an A-.
I don't think that's that aggressive. I think so. It's very easily A-, at least. I think I'm much hotter on Summer Seaport than you guys. That's true. I literally wish I could turn the fan on here in my office right now, but then you'd hear it through the microphone. Summer Seaport, I think, is fantastic. Played with it over the weekend, and it met and exceeded my expectations. I started at 2 and went up to 3. It's just so phenomenal with Dorn to be able to drop this out. Sure, you know, it takes me a little bit to fully pay back the gold investment, but not limited. Just made so much of a difference to not glut my hand. Plus the reserve boost between this and Dorn meant like I've just virtually ignored reserve in every game, even though I was triggering Dorn out the wazoo. You know, it sets you up so much better for kind of a first ed style usage of plots, resets and the like to be able to build that resource and location base and sculpt and keep that hand to a greater extent. I'm in love with Summer Seaport. I see myself playing it and the fiefdoms as I was this weekend. I will make room. Arch looks very good. He's another one that, like Roy said, he's just not gonna be played in Shadows. I don't see any good reason to tax myself an additional gold to get this effect out. Like, I'm not the gotcha moment of bringing him out of Shadows after my opponent has, I don't know, passed on some challenges and left extra characters standing or something. I don't know. It's just another one of these Shadows cards this set that is like kind of sideways from interacting with the mechanic in an interesting way, which arguably a lot of Bestow did as well.
So we need we need a third Martell card that reads, when you lose dominance, take a power from your opponent's house. So that I can lose dominance, discard a card from their hand, draw a card, kill something, and take away a power. Like if I win Worlds, I'm not winning Worlds. But if I win Worlds, that's what we're getting. It's gonna be Doran Martell, he's gonna be 3 costs, and he's gonna be like, when you lose dominance.
The sad part is, like, this deadly part of me thinks, you know, that actually kind of fits. Like, I could see that from a Martell theme and Doran's personality. But yeah, I don't think we need that added.
I mean, I personally need it, but let's continue.
Yeah,
reverse chamber, the chamber of the old wooden table.
Luke, did you throw out?
Yeah, I don't really have much to add. Yeah, I was gonna say I don't have much to add. I think both these cards are really good. I'm gonna give Martell an A-. Like, just everything that y'all said, I think it's pretty dope. Archibald is I like him.
He's the first Martell card I want to dupe since Rakasa. It's the exact right cost. Like, 5 is the best cost slot in the game. Can we all agree to that?
5?
Characters. Yeah.
Yeah, 5. Like, if you could have a card be any cost, like, assuming you're not just saying 2 is the craziest power in the world, right? Like, the best character cost slot in the game is 5. It's expensive enough that it can be super powerful, but not wordable, not vulnerable to a bunch of shit, and then it doesn't have, and it's still good against O'Harris.
I actually think until Great Hall rotates, 6 is going to be the best. For unique characters.
Sure, but like, 1, O'Harris, but 2, like, what's 6 minus 2?
4.
What's 5 minus 1?
4.
Okay, so we're good.
But you get more out of us, like, what I'm saying, like, the budget. The design budget for 6 cost characters is higher than for 5 cost characters. So with Great Hall, I mean,
I would take the best 6 cost the best 5 cost characters in the game above the 6 cost characters.
So you would take this over Wyman?
No, but I would take Ariane over one.
Oh, Core Ariane? Yeah, Core Ariane is one of the best cards in the game, but I don't think Wyman is very far away from her. But no, like, I take Wyman over Tyrion.
That's so I wouldn't. I mean, I would right now, because, like, Lannister is trash, but I think it's easy to forget how broken Tyrion is when the house is good.
Oh, but again, we're comparing at, like, the top end of the game, where, like, if I could run all these cards of, like, Core Arianne, like, an Alliance deck, a Stark Alliance deck, where I have Arianne and Tyrion and Wyman, I'm not complaining. Those are awesome cards. But when we're like, the margins of difference between them is so... You could.
I mean, there's a lot more to it than that, right? Like, what is your deck trying to do? And, like, is our kill effects a thing? And, like, how many shadows are you running? Are you running heavy shadows if suddenly Tyrion is better? Are you running a bunch of weenies that you just want to, like, keep tempo then suddenly? You know what I mean? Like, there's a lot more to it than that. Like, I don't think either one is especially better. But, hey, you know who else costs 5? Daenerys.
She does. Why she costs 5?
Is way beyond me, right? But that's what I'm saying. The top of the curve at 5 is straight up kind of nuts. Like, you know, the best error card is 5. Like, it's 5 is an extremely, extremely impressive. Like, I don't think 6 is necessarily designed as better than 5.
I mean, my very, very short addition is, I think 5 is the equivalent in second ed of the 3 cost sweet spot of first ed, but we're taking a deep dive into character cost slot analysis rather than chapter pack review.
Yeah, I mean, again, we're burning through possible topics.
Exactly.
Someone named Will should be writing these down so we have them for later.
But
got it.
Or poor fellows, I'll read that. Does that work for you guys?
Yeah, I'm reading King's Landing, so whatever.
Poor Fellows is a 2-cost, 2-icon, red and blue, 1-strength, non-unique, neutral character. Has the army and the 7 trait, no attachments. Reaction, after you win a challenge in which Poor Fellows is attacking, the losing opponent chooses either Poor Fellows gains 1 power or you draw 1 card. So, lots of things to say about this card. One, why was it not printed in the last cycle when the agenda that Danny designed, that this is designed to push, came out? They don't even rotate together, which is just weird to me.
In 6 years,
but anyway, yeah. But I just, like, that bothers me on a design level, but on a development level. But the card itself is busted. This is one of the strongest. I think it is the strongest 2-drop printed. It really pushes Faith Militant and factions that had good but marginal Faith Militant builds, like Baratheon, like Stark, that, like, even Tyrell. But Tyrell has so many more busted things it's doing in Faith Militant, but that it doesn't care. But there is going to be a good Faith Militant deck out of this from Tyrell, definitely in Stark, definitely in Baratheon. Just, this is the card when everyone's like, oh, all we need is a cheap body that you want to put in challenges that has the trait. Well, here is a cheap body that you want to put in challenges, because not only does it synergize with the agenda, it either is going to give you additional power or draw you a card. This is something we're going to see a lot of. and is definitely an A card. This is, I think, some of the best chud that Danny or Nate has printed in second edition. I mean, and yeah, probably shouldn't have printed it.
It's especially nuts in it's especially nuts in Mara, where you can just like take that power right off.
Mm-hmm.
Like you're just like, great, mm-hmm. that's going to go straight to my faction. Yeah. Yeah, it's this card should absolutely not have been printed. I don't know if it's broken yet, but we're getting real close. I think Baron and Stark are probably the only places that actually have Faith Hill Index, although Poor Fellows is pushing us an awful lot closer elsewhere. Gain a power or draw a card is just crazy strong. Like, I keep thinking, like, do all rush decks just run this because why not? It's two costs.
Yes. Yes. Like, totally.
Yes.
Like you're landing crossing. So this is better than Mermaid and landing crossing. Like, it's just straight up better.
Uh-huh. What's the two icons that make it better than the Mermaid?
The two icons, and like, your worst case is like, they cannot give you power, and now you're drawing cards, which you can then filter with the other thing. Like, it's just like, you're rushed. Like, between Faith Mill and Rush, this card is way too good for a neutral. Like, I wish this was a house power card.
You make a bear a yellow card? Like, it was printed in the faction, Baratheon? It should probably be a Lannister card, to be completely honest.
Yeah.
If we're going thematically,
yeah.
That'd be nice. I'd like
represent to Ciri's Cersei Rather's alliance with.
Yeah.
I don't know what Cersei's.
I would really like to see that represented.
That's true, but
like everyone can say, the Power King's Landing is technically Baratheon, even if it's Lannister.
Yes, I know, but the way in which the card game has differentiated them into factions has,
I think it
put. So, yeah, I think that this probably should have been, like, I'm actually surprised that there isn't a Lannister the Seven. Like, it isn't what a supported theme for Lannister, but, like, this
Lannister
is just
kind of have nice things. So,
The Lannister High Septon, there should have been. But, whatever.
I mean, there's still candy. The game has not ended. The dice game is not here yet.
We'll have to loop back around through the novels again before long anyway, but. Yeah, this card's just crazy efficient. I'm going to be that guy again to bring up First Ed, but like, I could see this just straight up being printed this way in First Ed, being entirely playable. And knowing the stratification of the gold curve in Second Edition, like, we shouldn't really be getting two-cost neutrals at that level of potency. And yet, here we did. This can just slot in all kinds of places. Like, anywhere. Rush. I could see this in some kind of, you know, tempo or control too, just because, hey, maybe it helps me close out a little, or if they give me cards, that's gravy.
Yeah, I hate this card. This card pisses me off. Like, I'm so, in just my limited exposure to the meta in over a year or so, like, I'm really sick of seeing a bunch of cards that don't actually, like, interact with the board state or, like, cards in hand or anything. Like, they just sort of, like, get better with the general framework of the game, and this is one of those cards where it's, like, it's cheap. So, like, one of the big framework things of second edition is to make economy a bit more rare. And then, like, it does something for just participating and winning a challenge as the attacker, which is something that you want to do anyway, no matter what faction you play. And then you, like, either get to draw a card to get that much closer to whatever it is you want, or you get to get that much closer to your win condition. I hate this card. It's awesome, but I hate it. Like, I hate, like, cards that just come into play and say, hey, like, if you're set up in the rules of the game better than your opponent, like, you're just doing better. I don't like it.
All right. Are we done with Poor Fellows?
I think so.
Okay.
Pardon me for being a curmudgeon.
You don't have to like that. You don't have to like things you don't like, man.
Yeah.
I'm going to read this card, and then I'm going to shut up and talk about it last. King's Landing. is a four-cost neutral location. It's traded King's Landing because sometimes people just don't feel like being brave. Once per marshalling phase, you may marshal location from your discard pile as if you're in your hand. Challenges action. Yield King's Landing and discard one location from your hand to draw one card. Okay. We'll talk.
Okay. I mean, sure, there's a little bit of fear that this gets bounced with breaking ties or gets seized, dumped on it, but like fair minimum, you're probably getting one use out of the recursion ability, which, depending on what you're pulling there, I think probably still offsets that quite a bit. And if it doesn't happen immediately and you get multiple uses, I think this sort of thing generates a ton of advantage for you. I mean, the challenges action there is a very watered down version of the road, but it's still potentially relevant. Plus, you get some, well, to finish that thought, I guess, part of me thinks, hey, maybe there's some kind of Lannister deck here that uses that together with the Gold Road, tons of limited and locations, just kind of dumps the excess, pulls it back as it can so it can build a resource base to use stuff like Cat's Paw more effectively. But we'll see. That's I think, a pretty mild, pretty tame interpretation of King's Landing, which probably looks a whole lot spicier with all of the sacrifice to do something or other locations. You know, like bare minimum cheapest end of things, you're looking at replaying Iron Mines so you can save somebody every turn. Or Spears of the Merlin King gives you a pseudo save, maybe lets you keep playing some reward character over and over every turn. Or, you know, with the higher end of kind of tempo curve, maybe you're looking at dropping Gaston Grey on them every turn of the game, which can be pretty intimidating to play against and is begging your opponent to get that analysis paralysis where they're afraid of misstepping, which is going to be great for you. And then you've got the option of something like Star Carenhall. I mean, sure, then you're looking at multiple four-cost locations and that sort of engine, but if you're killing something of at least four cost on their side every turn, play it. I think that adds up pretty quick. So yeah, I think I'm very, very intrigued by King's Landing. This is the sort of thing I want to brew with big time. It's got my Shaga wheels turning.
Rating? Well, what was your rating?
Oh, did I not give it a rating? Sorry, I do think this is an A.
Okay. Luke? Luke? All right, Roy?
So I think 4 gold neutral location is a lot to ask. And the question is where the card pool sits right now where this card wants... Is it where this card wants to be? I think the decks that want it are going to love it, and that's basically where it's going to be. I don't think this is kind of like, I don't think giving all like limited, turning all your limited cards later in the game into cycling cards in the challenges phase is super like great in just any faction. But I definitely think there are definitely decks, maybe like some of the stuff that Will listed off, that will like want it, but like an auto include in like every faction, like a flea bottom level, we'll see. Like, I think this is definitely the card that we're going to want to see people play with and that we're going to need data with before we can really draw strong conclusions. So I'm going to give this card an E where it is right now, because I think that the decks that want it are going to want to build around it and want to see where they can find the synergies for it. But I think that it's not going to just immediately slot into like every single deck as a 2X or even, God help you, a 3X.
Looky back.
Yep. I have absolutely no idea what to think about this card. Like, there's a lot of creativity that went into this design, and I really enjoy it. And the art is great, just as a side note. But this is not the type of card that I'm going to play. This is not my play style. I don't particularly care for it. But I think that once somebody figures out the 30 location deck that cycles like Sea Bitch plus Gas and Gray and other stuff, then maybe, sure. I can understand that. I'm still never gonna play that deck. So my rating of it is probably a little biased in that I think that this is probably somewhere in the middle in terms of a C-plus rating, because I think it's probably really good for the people who figure it out. And then for everybody else, it's just kind of a, oh yeah, I guess I have to deal with it if it becomes popular. So I'm going to sit right there in the middle, I think.
So because I want people to do some work and put some creative thought into deck building, which is my new thing if you listen to recent Second Sons, here's exactly how I want to say this. This is a card like Doharis where you have to think about how you're building your deck and what it's doing every time you sit down to build a deck by its sheer existence, whether it's great and prominently played or not. It is a meta-shaping card, and that to me means that the game from the point where this is released on will be a different game than it was before. Like it was with Doharis, like it was with the Duelist, like it has several other times, like it was with the Terrell Box, Ace dropped, and people figured that out. Certain things change the game by their very existence, and this is absolutely one, and it's an S card.
There we go. Very differing opinions.
Bless.
I honestly think you're probably more right than me. I just legitimately don't know how to interact with this because it's a card that I genuinely don't see myself playing. So it's probably my personal bias.
We'll see how it plays out in the wild. Glass Candle?
Who's doing Glass Candle? Oh my god.
It's a will card. It's a Shalka card.
You sound so excited about it. Sure, I'll take it. Glass Candle. The one cost neutral attachment, item, and the Citadel trait. Character you control only. And if attached character has the Maester trait, gains insight. Challenges action, kneel Glass Candle to look at the top card of any player's deck. You may discard that card. Boy, here's that sweet Maester tech we've been really wanting to pull those Conclave decks together, huh? This is one that I actually, I'm not sure I have a strong opinion about. I'm weirdly not sure this card's quite for me, and it maybe slots best into kind of a Shaga-ish sort of mill deck. Which maybe it's coming back together again if the internet buzz can be believed. But it, I don't know. It just feels a little boring to me as far as that kind of thing goes. Just slap it on a character and mill it every turn to mill a card. That just doesn't really get my creative or my Jamie competitive juices flowing, so I don't know. It's like a C.
What the fuck? Sorry, I'm reading. I just looked at the. Wow. Sorry, continue. Go ahead.
No, that, I mean, I think that was the end of my bit.
Okay.
So I am really disappointed in Will a little bit here, because Will, you play Magic casually. Right, this is clearly Danny. This card is definitely Danny the Magic player kind of card. Like, this is a Magic card that has some thrown stuff on it about Maester traits, and I think it's actually going to end up being better than people realize for a couple reasons. One, I think it's another tool in mill decks, which despite which are like all like sitting there in tier two or whatever Dave and the banter boys have anglicized rather what the tier list is sitting there firmly and is just waiting for more tools. And this is a powerful tool combined with Greensight, combined with Tywin, combined with Pillage to like really go to town on someone's deck. And then it's card quality. Like this is a combo enabling card. It doesn't kneel the character. You kneel it and you look at the top card of your deck. If it's not the thing you need, you just dump it in your discard pile. Increasingly, factions like Targaryen, but just neutral cards like Fleabottom are making like things being in your discard pile a lot less like of a big cost. And so that's a powerful effect in and of itself. And then, of course, if for deck for factions that like want to use its discard pile as a resource and wants to have cards in this discard pile, Glass Candle can be there. You might even weirdly see it in like Drown God decks as just a way, an addition like that are running Greensight as just an additional way to dump characters into its dead pile through Naga's Ribs. It's a sleeper card, and I would give it like okay. I'd give it like a C+. But I would definitely not be surprised to see this card played in the future in competitive decks, because we're getting to the point where the kind of interactions that Glass Candle pushes,
two quick
are going to be like present in the
number
meta.
One, I am a little surprised after you started off pushing back at me that you only went up a half letter rating compared to what I said. The other one is that's fair. They're just
letter ratings don't matter.
But for what it's worth, the magic comparison that I keep seeing people make, since you like alluded to it but didn't really quite clarify, the one I keep seeing people compare it to is Sensei's Divining Top, which is a wildly more powerful effect. For Brent,
no.
yeah. For listeners, not familiar,
you could draw an actual card.
Basically,
with it.
For
but Sensei's,
you pay one, you get to look at the top three cards of your deck. Then you can rearrange them. Then you can basically trade this card for the top card of your deck. So that's much deeper filtering than Glass Candle is capable of. So that's why I didn't go down that path when I was talking at first.
This card's stupid. I don't like it. I just don't like. I don't like anything that really like actively pushes that mill strategy in a game like Thrones. That takes, you know, X number of rounds, and then like, you know, if you're not playing against Rush, like potentially like an hour. Like I just hate that. It just pisses me off. I don't want this card in the game. I don't like it. And I'm not sure that I'm not sure I know how this is going to actually shake out in a competitive environment. I just think it's kind of stupid and just really don't like it. So I'm going to give it like
I'm the high man on this. I think it's a B card. I think that, we are dangerously close to Vampire and stupid goddamn deck becoming real. Like, it's just, like, it's not unique, man. Like, discard multiple cards a turn by kneeling this shit in the challenge phase is real good. Like, with all the extra pillage, we are dangerously close to real pillage. And I also agree that I think Pillage is the dumbest goddamn thing in the world. However, Glass Candle, like, combo is dumber than pillage, and then we have Dex Roy likes. So, like, that's the order of shit I hate in this game. So, I mean, Mace and Builders. So, it's just, like, but this is really, really, like, silly strong in that kind of deck, which is going to be a thing if it's not yet. And I don't think it is yet, but we're getting there. So, B. Who's on Easy Troops?
Not me.
Rogers. Rogers.
Yeah, but I just read Glass Candle.
Will's the melee player, so.
Oh, Glass Candle?
I mean, all right, sure. I'll finish it out. Uneasy Truce. It is a plot, the only plot in the pack. 4 gold, 5 initiative, 1 claim, 5 reserve. Edict and Summer traded. Each player cannot gain power for his or her faction except during challenges. Forced reaction. After a challenge is initiated, move 1 power from the attacking player's faction card to the defending player's faction card. This is probably primarily a melee plot. It might have some anti Lord of the Crossing tech in it, because they have to initiate 3 challenges or take the turn off, and that means they're giving you 3 power, which often will make, unless they have a ton of renown out, like make it a bit of a wash for them. So maybe it has some niche constructed, joust constructed uses, but if it had said each player cannot gain power except during challenges, this card would be much more powerful. But it doesn't turn Mace off. It doesn't turn variety of things off. So
let's go.
Yeah. So I would give this a C- in Joust and like a B- in Melee.
Yeah. Yo, this card's boring. Why are we talking so much about it? D, you're going to see it played once in a blue moon. Next.
I think I would also just kind of throw out there, you know, this is a variation on a type of plot we've seen before, and this particular one is noticeable, I think, in that the forced reaction, like, if they don't have power, like, nothing happens. They just make the challenge and do their thing. There's no penalty. To me, I don't know, maybe makes the truce seem not well enforced, but I agree it's primarily a melee plot to force power to kind of move around the table in, I think, some interesting ways. Probably as a turn 2 melee plot, I think, to slow that game a little bit. So I'm interested to see its impact there. I'll give it a B- for the melee application.
A stall plot that rewards passive power gain. Next. I don't know what I'm supposed to feel about this card. Like, I don't think it's actively bad in either Joust or Melee. I just think it's, like, kind of whatever, which means that it's, like, firmly in the C range for me. It's an average plot. Fine.
There we go. Man, that's a peck already. Whew. Well done. I just want to take a moment to congratulate my co-hosts for, I think, doing the fastest chapter pack review we've ever done. Certainly the fastest we've accomplished with 4 hosts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and me and Aaron are on the same episode.
It's true. So
that is particularly impressive.
Well played, gentlemen.
Not wrong. Raps and slaps. I got a prop and a slap.
Oh, okay.
They're not related. I want a prop Adventure Zone. D&D podcast by the My Brother and Me. Guys, it's fantastic. It's a lot of fun. I've listened to like 30 episodes in 2 weeks. And like I'm finding myself sitting in the car just to continue listening. It's really, really great. Check it out.
I've listened to the first like 3 or so episodes. It was kind of fun. I hear it really hits its stride a little later after that, though.
And I want to slap the AGOT.cards reviews because they seem specifically written just to make my head explode. So thanks, guys.
Yeah, well, the problem with moving those from CardGameDB to your website is now you have to be responsible for them. It's not just, you know, oh, that's CardGameDB. It's now that's agot.cards.
Oh, I don't know if I'm responsible. I think it's well known that that is Scantrell's project.
Mm-hmm. It sure is.
So I'm going to jump in, and I have two props and an announcement.
Ooh.
The first prop is I want to thank, I guess it's technically three props and an announcement. I want to thank the Thrones community for an amazing Gen Con. Gen Con also doubled as my bachelor party, with the party on Friday with the Thrones community being one of my favorite parties I have ever attended, and was huge. Just, it was an amazing and lovely experience. I really am grateful to everybody who was there, everybody who came out to the after party, that we sort of, thanks to Trey and Sandy for bribing the hotel to let us continue to party in their conference room. Conveniently, they complained before we paid them, but as soon as Trey's money was in the hands of the manager, he was suddenly quiet and didn't care how loud we were being. Anyway, so that's prop number one. Prop number two would be to my team, the Long Lances. We had an amazing Gen Con. We brought 11 players. 7 of them made Take 2. 3 of them made the top 16, and Jesse was in the top 8 and lost a heartbreakingly close game to try to break into top 4. We did extremely well, and I'm really proud of everybody and all the testing that we did, and I just wanted to say that publicly. And three would be, I want to prop Banner Saga 3, which I beat this morning. It's a little shorter than you would expect. I enjoy the first two Banner Sagas a lot, particularly the second one. And three is a satisfying, if too short, conclusion to a very solid series. If you can pick them up, particularly if they get bundled together during a Steam sale, I would definitely suggest doing it if you like tactical role-playing games with very solid stories and amazing art. And then last but not least, please come to Thrones Toberfest in 2018 here in Philadelphia. Registration for the event is live. Tickets are actually for sale now as well, so you can pick up your ticket if you are registered. It's amazing. We currently has, as of right now, 34 players registered plus our 8 regents, one of whom is also Aaron Glazer. And we have the draft, the player draft, on September 18th, live on Buzz's channel on Twitch with Sid and I as hosts. So really, you should sign up. You should come to Philadelphia. We have Scantrell, he was mentioned earlier, and his crew are coming up from Georgia. We have people from Tennessee, Fred Bird from Vegas, Jesse from the White Squirrel Nation. We've got some people from Chicago. We've got some of the indie crew. It's going to be an amazing experience. Red Caps is a great store to play in, and the store's being very supportive. So I'm really excited. So if you can come to Philadelphia on October 20th and 21st, you should, and it will be amazing. So please sign up for Thrones Toberfest, and I'm done.
Oh,
I have two props and two slots. Two props first. Props to everyone who I got to interact with at Gen Con, who I hadn't seen in a long time and was like really happy to see me. And props to folks who I haven't actually met before, but still recognized me from being on the podcast and saying hey during the joust. That was a ton of fun. And props to that after party for sure. And then my second prop is prop to the Miniature Wife and Other Stories by Manuel Gonzalez. It's a super interesting story collection. I highly recommend. And then slots to a literary magazine named New Pop Lit for just being a crappy literary magazine and supporting people who are hateful. And then slots to random pairings at Gen Con, giving me a Murderer's Row schedule at Gen Con. And particularly for getting paired with Sandy in the win and end game in round six of the Swiss on day one. Just flops to that in general, because Builders is an auto-lose matchup for my deck, and also because I just didn't want to have to play Friends, and I played Friends all flipping day. Except for Tyler. I played against Tyler Phillips in a really, really tight match, and I hadn't known him before, and he was such a really gracious opponent, so that was a good game. And so no flops to that. Props to him for being awesome and actually winning the whole thing.
Well said. Well, I've got a couple different things. The first one is just like, I guess maybe a news tidbit. I can't quite decide if it's a prop or a swap. It's maybe both, I guess. There's a portional prop, which is that FFG announced that they're making Star Wars X-Wing Worlds qualifier based. So, you know, you're going to have to get an invitation to be there, which I think they're probably doing in an effort to control their space needs, since X-Wing is both extremely popular for Worlds and takes the most space of any of the games they host Worlds for. Except maybe Armada. Armada takes more space, doesn't it? Less people, though. Anyway, I think that's interesting, but slop, I think, to the fact that it has a, to me, super confusing structure that they announced with, like, two different tournament circuits that aren't really clear, and I don't know, just seemed like a bit more of a confusing announcement than it needed to be, but maybe that's just because I'm not up to speed on the X-Wing tournament circuit at large. So, thought that was interesting. The other bit is a also both a prop and a slop. I'm going to slop myself, because there will be no episode next week, dear listeners. No episode drop on the 4th, because here's the prop portion. Kristen and I will be in Scotland. So, sorry, but not all that sorry. It'll be a good time. We'll be back to content after that, I'm sure.
And you do it. I don't like saying it.
Luke's literary magazine that I just Googled there really is in the danger zone. Like, that is some shit.
Oh, yeah.
So bad it should close a chapter on this episode of The White Book. So bad it should close a chapter on this episode of The White Book.